This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
We're really getting into now the streaming arms race.
Dish is looking at that and saying we can really build a nice niche for ourselves.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
The dollar is the dominant currency in the planet.
I think the acquisition is a natural progression of what Microsoft can do with this technology going forward.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we're going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries that our analysts cover worldwide.
Today, we're going to take a look at how the breakup of GE isn't a value play.
Plus, low-cost carriers are making gains as airlines use the pandemic to take market share.
But first, let's take a look and take stock of the stock market. That was kind of a pun,
but not really.
Okay. Here with us, Gina Martin Adams, Bloomberg Intelligence Chief Equity Strategist. Gina, it's been a while since you've been on with us. And what has changed is sometimes a steeper yield curve, sometimes a re-rating of the front end and the back end, and still record high prices and a lot of retail money still flowing into the hot stocks like Rivian, et cetera. Where are we?
Well, I think in terms of the equity market outlook, we're at a place where we're starting to digest the idea that the Fed is changing the game a little bit. Yet the economy remains much stronger than anybody had anticipated. Still, this far into the cycle, household spending is incredibly robust. Even with inflation pressures, companies continue to beat analyst expectations for earnings growth. And so the growth side of the equation is more than making up for any fears that the removal of Fed support may topple stocks. And I think that that's likely to continue in the near term, not to mention the fact that even if the Fed does remove support, they're not going to do so until the second half of next year. So we're more than willing to kick that can down the road for now.
One of the things that's, I think, really become clear, the consumer is really strong. Is that going to continue, do you think?
Yeah. Just to put it in perspective, you know, we had this incredible drop in retail sales in the early part of 2020. We more than made up for that drop within just a few months into economic recovery. It's something we've never seen in U.S. history, is such an extreme decline followed by such a rapid recovery. As a matter of fact, retail sales growth so far this cycle is three times the pace of growth seen in either the prior cycle or even the 2000 cycle. Incredible growth. And that's been powered by a combination of factors. Really strong income growth. Wage growth is also running at an all-time fast pace. You've had incredible wealth appreciation. You've got, you know, tons of federal support still inherently. Very low energy costs as a share of overall consumption. I mean, just nothing is in the way of households aside from inflation. And even that inflation, they're more than willing so far to absorb because they have these strong fundamentals. So I actually think it's more likely that the household continues to surprise us on the upside, given those supports, than to disappoint.
What I don't understand is that consumer sentiment rolls over as inflation expectations move higher.
Yeah.
The read-through is that consumers are worried about inflation and they don't want to spend and they don't feel good. And then you get really solid numbers. And even some of the retailers, they might have margin pressure, but their sales are awesome.
Yeah. So I think the read-through really is consumers don't like what they see with respect to inflation, but they're still more than willing to pay the prices. We have not gotten to that point where inflation really breaks the consumer. Or your alternative is the consumer is front running. So the more nefarious scenario here would be, oh, I see prices rising. I'll get it now because I'm not going to be able to afford it tomorrow or next year or the year after. There could be some of that happening. And the risk then is that the household does disappoint us coming into 2022 or 2023 because they're pulling forward purchases in anticipation of inflation.
And you've been very consistent, Gina, you and your team, to say, as we come out of this pandemic, don't just focus on the top line, focus on margins.
Yeah.
And we saw from some of the retailers, for example, Target, for example, you know, cite some of the margin pressure from supply chain, from labor, that type of thing. Is that to the point now where maybe my earnings story is a little bit at risk?
Yeah, it is for some, but not for all. It's amazing because we have not seen those margin pressures bubble up to the extent that they're taking over for the entirety of the S&P 500 by any stretch of the imagination. Instead, it's really selective. It's the majority of consumer staples companies are absolutely experiencing margin pressure and are experiencing downward revision to expectations for margins going forward. Some consumer discretionary companies, some industrial companies, even some tech companies have recorded downward revision to margin expectations. But the index at large still shows expectations for margin continuing to rise going into 2022 and 2023. So it is a company-specific, even industry-specific story, but then you can't really get beyond sector to make describe the margin story.
What kind of sectors do you invest in right now?
Yeah.
Because I also wonder what's already baked in at this point, and how do you front-run something that could happen in a year in the middle of COVID?
You know, I think that your best opportunities are still companies that are trading probably at a reasonable price, but more importantly, do have a tie to inflationary conditions, which are going to stick around longer than anybody had anticipated. I don't buy the idea that inflation is just going to disappear over the next year. And I never have. I mean, this is one of the reasons we're so worried about margins, and we want to watch them fairly carefully. So our strategy has really revolved around where you've got the greatest potential for margin stickiness in an inflationary scenario. I think it's way too early to say, hey, supply chains are going to clear up, and I want to buy those supply chain distressed areas or the supply chain constrained areas in the market right now. Instead, I think areas like energy or financials or even some of the communication stocks, which tend to perform very well when inflation is high and rising, are probably still your better opportunity.
Gina, thanks a lot. Gina Martin-Adams, Bloomberg Intelligence Chief Equity Strategist.
All right, coming up on the program, low-cost airlines are making gains in the battle for the global skies.
You are listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
So last week, I took my first trip post-pandemic kind of thing back and forth to Phoenix from New York. And I would say the load factor on my United flight was maybe 90%. We had some middle seats empty, which was very cool. But I tell you, people are back in the air. And I want to get an update on kind of what's going on in the airline business from a global basis. And our go-to person for that is George Ferguson. He covers airlines, aerospace, all that cool stuff for Bloomberg Intelligence. George, it seems to me as somebody who's just on an airplane, things are kind of getting back to normal. Am I right on that?
So I would say you're right when you think about the U.S. leisure traveler.
That's me.
Trying to get back to normal. And I think it's really, we're seeing the volumes. But our latest report, we look at Airline Reporting Corporation data on fares, and we're still seeing fares lag 2019 levels by a significant amount, by 20%+ in some markets. So, I think the airlines are doing a good job of pulling forward or pulling out demand for flying, especially for leisure flying. But again, it's still, they're giving up fare to do it. And we're especially concerned because costs are rising on them, right? Fuel price is much higher than it was in 2019. And labor expenses are going to be higher in 4Q as well.
Well, on labor, so we had, Paul went on a sojourn. He had a lovely time.
Yes.
I, on the other hand, went to D.C. on the shuttle last week. And it was my first time on a plane. Going there was fine. Coming back was a nightmare. In that, I could really feel the labor shortage. We get there and there's no one to, open up the plane from the outside. Multiple issues along those lines. How did these airlines wind up getting any kind of pricing power when they can't even open the door?
Yeah, that's going to be really hard. So, there's a lot of competition for workers. And the issue here is it's not pilots that are a problem. It's not flight attendants are a bit of our problem, but it's a lot of ground crew, right?
Mm-hmm.
Gate agents. And, all the companies that are reopening in America, all the restaurants, as Vegas reopens, those companies are looking for that same type of worker and they're bidding up the price of that worker. And I think the other problem is, right, if you think about being a worker in the airline industry, you just watch it go through a really bad event. You're not sure if it's totally out of the woods yet. And so you may think twice. You may say, look, I'd rather go work at a casino or go work at a restaurant and work for the airline. So it's going to be hard, and they know it. They're working hard to recruit people.
Yeah, and George, I can think of a Bloomberg News article recently about, looking ahead to the all-important holiday season and even Thanksgiving, expected to be back very, very close to 2019 levels in terms of passenger traffic. So there's the leisure consumer like you were talking about. What are the companies, the big airlines that you cover, what are they saying about the business traveler?
So they're all saying that business bookings are rising, which we agree, we see that happening. But still, we're not at 2019 levels on business bookings or on the average fare paid. We're still some over 50% away from getting back to 2019 levels of business bookings. And so, and that's especially challenging for United, American, Delta. I think one of the very interesting things going on in the marketplace, too, is that those low-cost leisure travelers, especially the upstarts, the ultra-low-cost like Frontier and Spirit, they're really adding a lot of capacity. Mm. They're really pushing down fares, again, to get people on their planes. And United, American, and Delta, they're lacking that business traveler, which is typically, a high ticket price, a good margin. And they're getting squeezed because they can't get costs down as low as those ultra-low-cost carriers. And therefore, it's even harder for them, right, because they need to try to match fares to compete with those carriers.
How long does that trend kind of last for? And what's like the end result for the big players?
Yes, so we think, this trend lasts well into 2022. We think work from home will affect sort of people traveling, right? If you're working from home, you're probably not as likely to be out calling on clients. We're seeing a spike in virus activity as well in Europe, in China, and even in the U.S., and that probably works a little bit against both leisure and business. But we still think at Bloomberg Intelligence that we're probably into 2022, maybe we get back to 80-90% by the end of 2022, but probably not a full recovery on business until even 2023-24.
George, I know the Dubai Air Show was held recently, some big orders, some big press. Who are some of the winners and losers there? Are the airlines still out there buying aircraft?
There are, and so those ultra-low-cost carriers I was telling you about, Frontier, their parent company, Indigo Partners, which also owns Wizz in Europe, and Volaris, one of the fastest-growing airlines in Mexico, they placed orders for 255 Airbus A321s. And so, what this reminds us is that, again, the competition is going to be intense in the future, right? Because 321 is the largest of the Airbus A320 family. Those airlines could probably put over 200 people inside that airplane. Really lowers costs for them. And they'll deploy them in domestic markets, against those big full-service carriers and the other low-cost carriers, Ryanair's and the Southwest's and such. And I think it just shows they're really focused on pushing down costs so they can push down tick prices and try to take more share. And it was a plus for Airbus. That A321 has really done well for them.
Oh, I just flew the 737 MAX. I felt safe. I felt like it was the safest
you
plane
did?
In the air. Yes, I did.
That.
And I just, I emailed George at the time. I said, I'm listening to what George has always said, which is the 737 MAX is probably the safest plane in the air right now.
Is that like one of the things where you get bed bugs in a movie theater and then like go to that movie theater because they just treated it?
Exactly. I'm not sure that was the analogy I was thinking of, but kind of. So, George, is that headache, the 737 MAX, is that in the rearview mirror of Boeing?
So not entirely, unfortunately, right? We're still waiting on approval to have that airplane flown in China and in Russia. But China is most important of those two markets. Right now, as we watch deliveries every month, Boeing is really lagging on deliveries. Airbus is doing much better. In the last month, Airbus put 10 A320 narrow-body type airplanes into China. Boeing doesn't have that outlet to deliver airplanes into. So it's hurting the deliveries. I think a lot of it is in the rearview mirror. I think a lot of the technical issues are done. They've worked with the FAA to really look at that airplane in entirety. And now I think it's a function of them just getting them. They have a lot of them stored, and they're trying to get that storage level down, almost 400.
Wow.
They frankly missed the target of cutting that in half this year because I just don't see it possible. But the big challenge now is getting them out of storage and to customers. And again, getting China to reopen their market for that airplane.
Good stuff. George Ferguson, senior aerospace analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence.
All right, coming up on the program, as the popularity of EVs rise, we're going to take a look at the impact on lithium.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies in 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via VIGO on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. It's 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We're here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analysts covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide.
So the EV craze was front and center this past week. You had huge moves in Rivian, huge moves in Lucid and Canoo. But one thing that often gets overlooked is what's key to these cars, and that's the battery. And in the battery is lithium. Let's break it down from the inside out with senior chemical analyst Chris Perella. He's the guy I literally talk to when I need the in-depth take on EV. So, Chris, first of all, basics. How much lithium is in an EV battery?
You know, it's about 9% of the cost of an EV battery, a couple percentage points of the total cost of the battery there. So it's a small component. It is an important component, but it's the one that drives the electric vehicle revolution.
Where do I get lithium?
There are a couple places in the world right now where you can easily get lithium or economically get lithium. Chile, Argentina, Western Australia, and then most of it is shipped over to China where it's processed to battery chemicals, which then find its way into the car batteries.
So if that's the case, when we have all the supply chain issues, et cetera, that we've had, the port congestion, the zero tolerance COVID policy over in China, has the lithium supply been super messed up?
It's a function of logistics issues, yes. It's been an issue getting lithium in and then sometimes moving it out of the country there. It's also been a function of underinvestment. The price of lithium sank prior to the pandemic, put the brakes on a lot of projects. It's come storming back. People are trying to get lithium where they can. The spot market is very tight. And those projects are finally starting to get moving again. 2021 was a good year for investment in lithium, and it's going to continue. But we're behind the curve on lithium investment globally.
And Chris, you mentioned, you're talking about the supply chain of lithium, some Latin American countries, China. What I did not hear is United States. Is there lithium? I don't know. Where's the United States in this whole supply chain of lithium?
The United States is far behind in the lithium supply chain here. China's really taken the lead internationally, stitched together a network of battery components, metals, manufacturing capability. And the U.S., outside of Tesla and their local battery production, is lagging far behind. We have some domestic lithium production out in Nevada. There are projects in North Carolina, Arkansas, and even in Utah where they're exploring for lithium, but those are a couple years behind, and they're not nearly at the scale that we see down in Chile, Argentina, or out in Western Australia.
All right, I think it's worth taking a moment and getting super nerdy for a second, because there's two ways that you can find lithium. One is through brine, and one is actually mining it. Can you walk us through the distinction and like why I should care?
The distinction is, to get nerdy, there's two battery chemicals for lithium, lithium hydroxide and lithium carbonate. Now, the hydroxide is for the longer range cars. The lithium carbonate, to break it down simply, is for the shorter range cars. The brine, the extracting the lithium from brine, which we see down in South America and parts of the U.S., is lower cost for the lithium carbonate generally. The lithium hydroxide is cheaper to make from crushing the ore that contains lithium, which you get from Western Australia and then process over in China. So there's two routes to lithium for batteries. They both have their uses, but one raw material is cheaper than the other for the various uses.
Chris, I've heard just about every major automobile manufacturer globally saying our future is electric, and with some really aggressive timetables. So I'm thinking I need to be long some lithium here. Mm-hmm. How do investors typically try to get that exposure to what should be, you know, a raw material that's in demand for a long time?
Yeah, in the U.S., out of U.S. equities, Albemarle, SQM, and Livent are the leaders from a U.S. perspective. There's two large Chinese players, Ganfeng and Jiangxi. Those are the top five globally, and there's a spate of lithium projects. You have Lithium Americas, which is ramping production and should be online with commercial product in the very near future. And then there's a host of exploration projects that automakers, battery makers, cathode makers, everybody's investing in. Everybody's trying to secure supply this year. And that's going to be an ongoing trend into 2022 and 2023.
What I find weird on that, though, is that a few years ago, when these EV targets were still huge and there was still an EV craze, Tesla was still around, the automakers were moving into EVs, a lot of these miners worked really hard to get supply out and prices crashed. How cyclical is this industry?
It's a very young industry, so we definitely went to a top and a bottom from 2016 through 2019 and into 2020 and completed a whole cycle in about 4 to 5 years there. Right now, the industry is behind about a year on capacity additions due to the pandemic, due to that crash in the price of lithium. It's going to take some catching up. It's going to be interesting to see if the industry gets ahead of itself again.
Chris, always good to catch up. Really appreciate it. Chris Perella, Senior Chemical Analyst over at Bloomberg Intelligence.
Coming up on the program, we break down GE's breakup.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
One of the biggest stories over the last few weeks was the dramatic breakup of General Electric. You have the aviation business, you have the power and renewable business, you have the industrial side.
Do they still make light bulbs?
No.
Do they? No.
They sold that business.
Okay.
Yeah. Washer and dryers? No. Karen Ubelhart, that's who you just heard. A Bloomberg Intelligence senior industrials analyst who's been covering GE for many, many, many years. You were not surprised that they broke up, but you were surprised in the timing.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I thought that was the eventual end game, as I think most people did. But 3 years, 4 years down the road, when power is as fixed as it's going to get, and they are three dissimilar businesses, I thought healthcare would be earlier. But I'm a little surprised. So I'm surprised. I'm not surprised at the announcement. I'm surprised by the timing of the announcement. Yes, I think the final close will be 2024. It seems a little early to be announcing it.
So why are they, other than to juice the stock?
Well, what's next from here was just operate the businesses better. Watch a slow recovery in aviation. Healthcare's fine. And just keep trying to fix power. And that's all that was going to happen, from here. Because all the big stuff was done. So now we have another big thing to look forward to.
What would you value each separate company as?
Well, I did some of the parts. And of course, the biggest value is in aviation. And I did it based on 2022. And you've got the whole company, you've got enterprise value for aviation, like $70, $75 billion. Healthcare, $55, $60 billion. And then the problem child, about $25 billion for the energy business, which is power and renewables. That could even get a discount. Hmm. But all that gets me to, relative to the enterprise value of where they are now, it's a little bit more now. It's about 15-17%. When I wrote it, the piece, it was more like 10% plus, but the stock has gone down. It's actually down from before they announced it.
Really? Yeah. And I guess one of the issues here is, this is clearly this management team just throwing in the towel on what was the GE that we all grew up with. Does that mean
GE died, I feel, a long time ago?
From a stock price perspective, absolutely. But now from a corporate perspective, they're throwing in this whole conglomerate towel, right?
Yeah. Well, we're in that phase of a cycle, right? When I got in the business, diversifieds were good things. And then we broke them all up in the 80s. And then we put them back together. And when I started covering multi-industrials, they sold at premiums. Mm-hmm. And then that whole idea got out of favor. And there's been pressure to break up. And that's only accelerated.
Do you think we'll be sitting here in 10 years having the exact opposite conversation and how GE broke up its business and how dumb that was?
I think we'll be putting things back together. I don't know if it's 10 years. I don't know if it's 15 years. But remember, these businesses are very deeply cyclical, particularly aviation, power. So you have no offsets if you break yourself up. The argument we wrote about was breaking up Emerson. Well, you can also make a counter argument that their climate business does offset their heavy late cycle
automation solutions business. So you can go either way. And what I think is going to happen, we'll have a bad cycle someday.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they're going to say, we have nothing to insulate us from these big moves in the economy.
So the power business, tell us what the GE power business is and what's wrong with it, and maybe hopefully what can be done.
The power business, the biggest piece, well, the biggest piece of that is the big gas turbines that you use for in electricity generation. They made a mismove in that they were in the, they're in the mega turbines because that's where you make more money. But the world is going towards more smaller and distributed power.
Okay.
They bet wrong. So did Siemens. So they ended up with, you know, 50% more capacity in the industry than they needed. GE also had some difficulty in pricing contracts to get because the business had shrunk, and so everybody chased bad contracts. So there's some of that, and there was some accounting issues about how they booked their service business, their service contracts. So
can they turn that around? Because being in the alternative power industry, and that's where it's going to be in the next like 30 years. Like that, like that's where all the growth is going to be and the money is going to be made. Can they do anything with that now?
They have renewables, which is wind power. It's just wind power.
Right.
And they're actually number one in wind power in the U.S. So they've got that to offset some of the... I mean, gas power is going to be here. We're not going to wipe out every gas energy plant, I mean, you know, power plant in the world, right? Coal's dead, but there is still opportunity. Well, coal's not dead globally, but there is... I think gas is going to have a play, but it's not going to be a growth business. And fixed... when they in 2024 they hope to have a low single digit growing business with margins of mid single digit to high single digits, like 5 to 8 percent margins.
What kind of returns does that business model generate for shareholders?
I think that's going to be the problem in terms of this whole divestiture thing. Aviation, they own the engine business; it's a terrific business. Margins are in the 20% when you know when it's good. Healthcare is a very good business. Once it's on its own, they can now invest in more growth because they're in the big capital equipment, you know, the imaging stuff. Power is a problem.
Are all power businesses like this right now?
Well, it's funny. Not the three bigs are big ones are Mitsubishi, Siemens, and GE in the turbine business. And Mitsubishi is in smaller turbines. That's the core of their business, and they're in Asia where it's growing more. And so they're doing better than the other two.
Karen is the smartest person that you'll ever hear talk on industrials. So you just had a moment there. All right, Karen Ubelhart, Bloomberg Intelligence senior industrials analyst. Thank you so very much.
All right, let's switch gears and talk banks. And I want to talk European banks, and we can do that with Philip Richards. He's a senior banking analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. So, Philip, you know, we're tail end of kind of the earnings season here. Generally, some good numbers coming out across the economy. We'd love to get your 30,000-foot view for how the banks are looking right now in Europe and kind of what's your outlook for 2022? Because it sounds like, it looks like, it feels like rates are going up.
Yeah, it does. And I think to answer that, it's probably worth just taking one step back in terms of, you know, where we are for the banks. Because when the pandemic hit of the early last year, the sector fell about 45%, so almost halved in value. And obviously that was a load of fears for the banks in terms of, they might have, first of all, much higher surging bad debts. Also a big concern over the revenue outlook for the banks, because, of course, when economies start closing down, economic growth will be hit. And also central banks will look to offset that by cutting interest rates. And that's really the main driver for banks in terms of their revenue lines. So the fears were for the sector then is rising bad debts, revenue getting much worse. And then to throw that even worse again, also the regulators started capping dividends and buybacks that the banks could do. The reason being they wanted them to hold on to the capital they had. So that's what led to that real collapse in the sector. But then over the last 12 months or so, the sector's completely rallied back, up about 90%. And basically, we're basically back to where we were when the whole pandemic began. And the reason I've basically gone through that process in terms of explaining where we are now is kind of like, you know, the easy money has almost been made for banks. You know, they had this big concerns. They've now gone. We're kind of back to where we are. But how do we go do that next leg of the sort of cycle and push ahead of where we were 18, 24 months ago? And that's when I think it is quite difficult. It's not a case of, you know, all banks are going to keep rising like they have done over the last 12 months. You know, we're back to where we were, and you need special areas to look for. So you mentioned about these 3Q results. Very clearly, I mean, bad debts were tiny, in fact, actually negative, and the lowest rate they've been in 15, 20 years. And the reason for that is because all the big charges the banks took at the beginning of the crisis, at the beginning of the pandemic, they've now been giving them that money back. Those bad debts never happened, and therefore the banks had all those extra reserves. So that's what the main reason, therefore, that say the numbers have been very good. But so going into next year, you know, are we going to get those extra boosts again? And the answer is probably on the bad debt front, yes. There probably will be another couple of quarters of very low charges. But then they're going to gradually get back to more normalized levels next year. Mm-hmm. So really, in terms of, you know, where do we go, how do we really get excited about the banks again? I think it has to go back down to the top line, mm-hmm. the revenue outlook. And you mentioned there, you know, about whole interest rates. And I think certainly the case, if you look at it in the US or if you look at it in the UK, that's absolutely the story. And one of our key areas we look at is for the UK banks and really focus on, you know, see those rising rates and which banks are going to be in the best gear towards that. And that's why we're really saying that Barclays, Lloyds, NatWest, they're some of the banks which could be best placed, you know, if rates do start rising and therefore the bank's margins start going up.
Hang on a second with that, because in order for them to take advantage of rising rates, they have to actually be making loans. Are they making loans?
They're starting to, and that's exactly the thoughts about the economy as well. Certainly it was on the corporate side where the loans really slowed during the crisis. But that confidence is beginning to come back again. You're seeing the reason that interest rates are going up, inflation's getting higher, people are getting a bit more confident under the outlook for the banks. So yes, where there is growth, that obviously absolutely you're right. You need both together. You need higher rates and loan growth. But I would say in both cases, the UK banks are probably a better place than, say, most of the Europeans.
So, Philip, I spent a large part of my career in the financial services industry, so naturally I think about compensation. Are the banks paying up to keep their talent there, and is that a margin risk for these banks as they see top-line improvement?
It's definitely flagging as one of the key risks we're facing, yes. I mean, certainly there's been a lot of press talk on it, and certainly I think a lot of the increase in wages, etc., has been more at the lower end of the wage bracket. So not the CEO, the top tier, where the inflation of wages has not been that great. However, we haven't really gone through a whole annual cycle in terms of, you know, it's only the last 6 months or so, and people got much more confident, and so the bonus round will be, you know, for the sectors will be coming up over the next few months. So I guess we don't know the answer to your question, is what I'm alluding to. But the fact that the traders have done very well this year, and if the outlook's better, then absolutely it looks like that will be the case. So absolutely there is cost pressure for the banks.
All right, Philip, thanks so much for joining us. Philip Richards, BI Senior Banking Industry Analyst, calling in from London.
All right, that's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.